Okay, we'll continue anyway. So, we've discussed a technique for calculating a basic confidence interval, and that means that we've calculated our system estimator, in this case, the estimator of the system mean, and we've then said that there's some interval around that estimator that with a certain percentage of confidence, 95%, 90%, we know that the actual system parameter will be in that interval. Okay. And calculating that interval, we based it on some multiple of sigma relating to the system variance. So the first observation we have beyond that is that we don't actually know what sigma is. Sigma is, again, a system parameter. At best, we can estimate system parameters. And so instead of using sigma, we use our unbiased estimate of sigma. And that you can put it into whatever form you want. Okay. Once we have our unbiased estimate of sigma, we just plug that into our values to get our confidence interval. So for the example, we have a confidence level of 95%. We say our confidence interval is the estimated mean minus our multiplier that we looked up from the normal tables times our estimate of sigma, which is in terms of S and our estimate of sigma over square root of n. Okay. So again, the more n you take, the smaller your confidence interval is going to be. You're taking more and more and more observations. Again, the more observations you take, if there's an outlier, the influence of that outlier is going to be less and less. Okay. Now, the second observation is about the number of observations we take. So we said rule of thumb 30 is good. If your simulation is taking a day to run, which they can take weeks to run, then it's going to be fairly painful to produce 30 of them. Yeah, it is possible to get on with less estimates. What we observe is in that case, the distribution you get is, the distribution of your estimators is not going to be normal. Typically, what we use instead is what is called the student's T distribution. And one interesting thing about the student's T, sort of for local knowledge, is that it was first published in English by, William Seeley Gossett, who was working in 1908, and he was working for Guinness Breweries at the time. It is called students because employees of Guinness were not allowed to publish scientific papers corporations all over the world. They were worried that somehow this would give away some trade secret. And so he published it under the pseudonym student. So, anyway, just a little local connection there. the again, it's fairly, you know, it's a bit complex, but we're just going to use it. This distribution gives sort of higher weighting to the tails, so it's not as sort of as tight in for any given standard deviation. You'd expect more to be outside that standard deviation in a student's T distribution than you would in a normal distribution. So one way you can interpret this is you're trying to be more conservative with your estimate. Your interval is, the interval you calculate is going to be wider. So again, the main thing we're worried about is just using the darn thing. And so the one additional complication of a student's T is that this distribution is dependent on the number of samples. So returning to the question, when we said we had enough samples for it to be normal, that was the end of the matter. Now it matters whether you have 5 runs or 10 runs. Okay, and this arises in the degrees of freedom, which are the degrees of freedom in this case is the number of runs minus 1. And I'll defer a discussion of what exactly degrees of freedom means till next lecture. You think this stuff is fun? Just wait till next lecture. But now it is dependent on degrees of freedom, but we do exactly the same thing with it. We use it to calculate a multiple of our standard deviation, or in this case our estimate of standard deviation, but again it's based on a different distribution. Okay. So now, what we're concerned with, you know, first and foremost, we have to look at the number of runs, and so which correlates to the degrees of freedom. So you know, as an example, we'll say we have 11 runs. That gives us 10 degrees of freedom. So that's this highlighted line. Here, the degrees of freedom is running down this first column. Now, again, this table, it's expressing similar information to the normal table we saw before. Of course, it's packaged slightly differently or represented slightly differently. Now, we're not dealing with the probabilities between the mean and some multiplier of sigma. We're dealing with the probability of being greater than that multiple of sigma. So we're dealing with the weight in the edge. Okay. We're still considering half the graph, so one side of the symmetric tail. Now, essentially what we want is we want the 95% to be between, to be centered around our actual system mean, or our, whatever our system parameter is, or the mean of our system parameter. That means that 5% is going to lie outside that. And so, if we look at only one half of this, if we only look at one side of this graph, that means that 2.5% needs to lie on this side of the interval, on the top side of the interval. Okay. So what we really want is 0.25, and unfortunately we. Okay. So this is so. Now we have our probabilities, and so. 2.5 percent is 0.025 as a probability. And so we have our degrees of freedom of 10. 0.025 is the probability that we need, and that gives us this value here, which, yeah, I think there's a slight typo there. Okay. Now, this gives us the multiplier of our standard deviation that we need, and again, we build our confidence interval using that multiplier and the estimate of our standard deviation. So the approach is just the same. The thing that you need to be aware of is when to apply each technique. And again, the cutoff is around 30 anyway.
30 is the sample size.
It's the number of runs you have done. So yeah, each run gives you one sample. So you can think of it as a sample size. Yeah. So if you do less runs than 30, you probably want to use the student's T table. To note, as the number of runs increases, this distribution actually approaches, again, the normal distribution. So you'll get the same, more or less the same values, sort of, as the number of runs increases. If you look at 30 as a specific instance, well, you can see that this multiplier, we had 1.96 before, now we have 2.04227. So, again, we've got this slightly more conservative estimate giving us a slightly bigger interval, saying we're not quite as sure where our values lie. Or...
Well, I'm lost here as to my understanding is that you're putting in values initially at the start of some system. Okay? You're coming out of the envelope, you're measuring some other random variable out of the system. Maybe what's the weighted capital.
Yeah.
You have the initial value that you put in basically determines ultimately what your average value of that waiting time will be depending on the system, okay?
Well, it determines...
It does. In fact, your system doesn't change for either of your own.
Well, except the steady state says that the influence of the...
I mean, being that you're putting in initial values at the start, right?
What they do is means that the behavior you observe is different.
Yeah. Behavior of the system.
Yes, the behavior of the system is different.
You derive some random variable based on whatever. It doesn't really matter. You have some random variable, you're waiting time. That then, at the end of it, depending on, you run 30 runs through, you have 30 estimates, let's say, your random variable, the Q waiting time, the Q whatever. Then you're gathering these and you're applying this student's T to these. Now, what I'm lost is, what is the confidence? Is the confidence interval for the 95% confidence interval that, regardless of what, that your population of the waiting times, if that's your population, you're saying that the 95% pile is that, regardless of that population.
95% of them will fall. Yeah. You have to think about it. Okay. So, what we've attempted to do anyway is to explain what we mean by confidence intervals, and the starting point for that is to realize that even though you've arrived at a number, that number is not guaranteed to be the actual system value. Okay. And the confidence interval gives you some measure of how close it is to the system value. And again, the problem is that you can always get unlucky, and you can be in, you, for one reason or 20 others, you could be outside it. But generally, you know, if you have a good confidence interval, 95%, 99%, and a relatively small, or sorry, good confidence level and a relatively small interval, you can be pretty happy that you have probably got a good estimate of the system. And the bottom line of that is you just then take it as your system estimate. Okay. So we looked at how this, running through this, we were looking at how this worked for mean values. And pretty much it works the same for the other terms we looked at. So other issues that we've got, other system parameters that we've considered before, probability of the random variable lies in some interval, percentiles, so again, and finally, variance. And so essentially, we can do the same thing for those estimates that we've been doing for the mean. So we calculate them. We calculate a value for the estimate for each of the runs. We average those values, and we then calculate a confidence interval around that. Okay. The only exception to that is variance, and I'll say why, and just as a note of caution to just always applying this technique. So, again, what's the probability, or how do you calculate the probability that a random variable lies in an interval? So as an example, what's the probability of a customer waiting more than 5 minutes for service? And so, again, we do a run, and we calculate this for the run. Okay. So you can observe the total number of customers and the number that are waiting more than 5 minutes. The ratio of that will give you your estimate. Again, that's a random variable. It's an instance of a random variable. So we can do the same thing for n runs. And then, again, take an average of those and use that as our system estimator. And really, everything works exactly the same way it did as we've been describing. Okay. We can use this to build up any sort of, we can use this to build up a distribution for our variable, so you can estimate, again, being in specific intervals, sort of like a histogram. Okay. So, that can be related back to doing our mean estimates. As follows, and again, this is just, it's almost just two different ways of viewing the problem, and depends, you know, which one you want to use depends on exactly how you want to calculate your variables. But so you can have some interval, and you want the probability to estimate p, the probability that we're in that interval. And so you run, you know, of course you're going to run a bunch of times. Now for each run, we collect n observations of x, and vi was the number of times x was observed to be in I. And so we can calculate this probability, and again take the average to calculate overall. Okay. As an alternative, you can see this as an estimation of mean problem just by doing a transformation on the variables. So y equals 1 if your variable is in I and 0 otherwise, so that's a random variable, and you can just move on from there. Okay. But in either case, what you can do is you can just build up representations of the probability distribution of a system just from observing, or of a variable just from observing various runs of it. And again, the two things to remember is, one, how do you gather the data? And then two, that you can just apply the same technique of sort of averages to the data. Okay, so again, percentiles can be handled in a similar way. The key is to lies in how you calculate the percentiles, and typically what you're going to have to do is just gather large observations of whatever value you're calculating the percentile on. So for an example, what's the maximum waiting time experienced by 95% of our arrivals? You could take 100 observations and count out to the 95th one. You could take 1,000 observations, count out to the 950th one. Okay. Obviously, the more observations you take, sort of the finer you would expect to get a sort of a more precise estimation of your value. Okay. So, but again, what we're going to do is take a number of runs, calculate our value for each run, and then use the average value as our estimate. Okay, so just a few things to note and to be careful of if you are doing such a calculation. Extreme distributions will require long runs, so if your values are quite spread out, then obviously if you don't take a very long run, you can sort of plus or minus one in that ordering can make a big difference. Okay. Similarly, if your percentile is quite tight, then again, it's sort of stretching out your, it's the same thing, stretching out your observations. So it's the 9,999th and the 1,000,000th are going to be fairly far away from each other. So you need to match your runs to the granularity of your percentile observation. Okay. The easiest way to do this calculation is just to dump all your data and sort of process it after the fact. You can avoid that by constructing a frequency histograms of binning up data into intervals as you go along, but then the interval size will impact the the accuracy of the method. So if your intervals are too wide and there's too many observations, you're not going to be able to get sort of your specific observation pinpointed out. Okay. But again, once you've collected the data, the same techniques apply for calculating confidence intervals. Okay. The only place our procedure comes slightly unstuck is in the estimate of variance. And so now we have a number of runs, and we want to calculate our variance for each run, and then overall calculate the average of that variance. Well, to start with, we'll need to know the mean, so we can have a mean estimate, and then we have the average of those mean estimates gives us our estimate of overall system mean. Now, for each run, we can calculate variance. It's the values minus the mean squared averaged out. Okay. And what we see is that these are a function of our mean estimates. Okay. That, so now when we do our point estimate, well, we can similarly, the point estimate then is just the average of our run estimates. But what we have to observe again is that each of our run estimates is a function of our mean estimate, and therefore the run estimates in this case are not uncorrelated. Okay. There is some relation between the estimates. Okay. So the bottom line for that is that you need to have some way of dealing with correlation if you're going to try to do a variance estimate. For our purposes, we'll mainly stick to not trying to do that. Okay, so what we've done so far is we've looked at various statistical parameters of the system, the mean, interval, percentile variance, and we have said that by using a number of independent runs to derive independent samples of these values, we can estimate the overall system value. Okay, and again, that's with the small exception of the variance, where you do have a correlation issue. Okay. So now what we need to do is to look at, again, just a few details about how you do actually obtain independent observations. The most obvious way, naturally, is just run different runs. There are other options. And then we'll wrap up by saying a few words about correlation and how we can deal with that. Okay. So, again, what we've said so far works as long as our samples are independent, and in most cases, a sufficient condition for getting that independence is just sort of running different runs of the system. So starting off at slightly different starting points and moving on. Okay. Peros describes three methods for doing this, batch, replication, and regenerative method. And we'll discuss two of these, the batch and the replication or the runs method. We won't bother with the regenerative method. It only works in sort of certain types of systems, ones where the state is going to return to a fixed point periodically. So it's more specific. Okay. So the replication method is exactly what we've been discussing for all along. We just run our model a fixed number of times. Okay. So we can then use our mean estimates to estimate the system parameter. And the primary thing that you have to be careful of with using this method is that your runs have always reached steady state as you're gathering your statistics. Okay. Okay. So, frequently, what we might like to do is to actually run our system enough times so that we'll achieve a specific confidence interval. So we want to be within plus or minus 10%. So that's a confidence interval. And so what you'll have to do to, as we said, the more runs you do, sort of the tighter your confidence interval becomes. So essentially what you're trying to do is estimate the number of runs that you need to perform to do that. And so to do this, you can estimate your standard deviation and then just realize that the confidence interval is going to vary with the square root of the number of runs times the standard deviation. And a second method that's often used is you just keep, as you're doing your runs, you can keep a tally on the confidence interval. I mean, this requires, of course, that you actually be able to sort of do that. And you can stop as soon as you've hit the confidence interval you require. Okay. So most likely you're going to just run a number of runs and calculate and see where you are from there. And then again, you can scale up if you've run 10 runs and you're asserting confidence interval. Well, again, you'll be able to sort of estimate how many more you need to get the confidence interval to where you need it. Now, the second method is the batch method. And in this case, what we do is we just run the same simulation for a very long period of time. And then we cut our trace or our observations up into fixed length batches. Sorry. And we calculate our statistics for each of these batches in turn, and then take the, as the estimator, the average of our batch statistics. Okay. So the one thing that this, one plus of this is that well, your initial conditions only have to be sort of accounted for once. One negative of this is that there is correlation between batches. So the value at one edge of a batch is going to be correlated to the value at the other edge of the next batch. So XB is going to be correlated to B plus 1. You know, again, think back to that Q length. If you know the Q length at one point, then you know, in any nearby point, you're going to have some clue as to what the Q length is going to look like. Is it big? Is it small? So there's some correlation. Well, they're just chunking up your observation. And what we say, you could ignore, you could take one sample, ignore some values, take the next sample, and then you wouldn't have this correlation issue. But then you're also running it for longer to get the same amount of data. The other way to get around this is just if your batch length is long enough, then again, it's sort of like the, you know, not worrying about the initial conditions. If you go long enough, then the influence of the correlation disappears after a while and is swamped by the rest. So again, that just gives you a second method for gathering observations. Okay. And the issue now for this method is to pick how many batches and what the length of the batches is. And again, this is related to trying to get a confidence interval that you're happy with. So the more batches you run, the tighter your confidence interval. Okay. So I'm just going to mention correlation now. I have yet to ask a question on an exam about it, but it's worth, again, being aware of. Everything we've done is predicated on our observations being independent and identically distributed. And as we've seen, there are times when this independence isn't the case. Okay. So if the observations are not independent, then it's possible to essentially make adjustments in your estimate based on the level of interdependence and proceed from there. But so the concept of covariance is, again, it's a measure of the lack of or the interdependence of two random variables. So if we have a random variable x with a mean mu x and a variance sigma x squared, and a random variable y with a mean mu y and a variance sigma y squared, then the covariance is the expectation of x minus mu times y minus mu. If x and y are independent, that covariance is going to be zero. If they're independent, then this splits out into two, the product of the two individual expectations, and obviously the expectation of x minus mu x is zero. Okay. If they're equal, if x equals y, then the covariance is obviously just going to be the same as the variance. Okay. So again, that gives us a measure of how dependent the variables are on each other. Okay. Correlation is a normalized version of covariance. So it'll fall between 0 and 1 then. And what we are looking for in our observations is autocorrelation. So if we have, so it's a correlation, we have a sequence of observations, so it's a correlation between different elements in that sequence. Okay. And so again, if we have n observations, then we can estimate the correlation. And typically what we do is we look at pairwise correlation, and then we start with the pairs being, you know, a value and the next value, and then we move to the pairs being further apart from each other. Okay. So our autocorrelation between successive pairs, so pairs next to each other, is just given by, well, you can estimate the correlation, and this is called a lag 1 autocorrelation. And then we can again look at pairs that are further away, or k away from each other, and that's lag k correlation. And typically, that value is calculated for values that are less than n over 4. So it's not calculated out to the nth value. And again, I will just note that this estimate of lagged autocorrelation can be used to estimate variance in the system. So we take our initial variance estimator and we adjust by our lagged correlation variables. Okay. So again, as far as this course is concerned, we're not really going to go into variance estimates. We're going to sort of confine ourselves mainly to mean estimates, but it's worth, again, tucking into the back of your mind if you are doing variance that there is a little bit more work to do. Okay, so we'll wrap up now. To some extent, it's straightforward, but it looks a bit strange the first time you see this, so again, have a think about it, particularly the idea of confidence intervals. And again, just getting the indexing straight from sampling in one run to averaging across multiple runs. Again, what we can do with that is we can estimate statistical system parameters. The main one that we're usually concerned with is mean or average of some quantity, but there are others. And so in order to do this, you have to generate these independent samples, or if they aren't independent, then fix them so they look sort of independent, and take the average. If you take the average of the values over the independent samples, then you say that this is a reasonable estimate of your actual system parameter. What we mean exactly by reasonable is contained in the concept of concept interval, confidence interval. Okay. I'm going to leave these last two slides because they, or at least just go over them quite quickly, because this will become the topic of our next lecture, specifically in terms of input validation. And, what we've done today is we've looked at a way of getting a meaningful performance estimator out of the system. What the concept of validation is getting at is the question of, is the model itself meaningful? Are you actually representing the system the way you want to? Okay. And so, you might want to check your input variables. Are your random number generators doing what they should be doing? In some cases, you can check your output. If you're modeling a system that's up and running, and you're just you're trying to see how it would react to different loads, well, yeah, you can observe the actual system since it exists. You can observe your model, and you can see how close what you observe with your model is to the actual values of the system. If you don't have a real system to work with, then there's a big question of how well is your model representing what you want? So how is the simulation logic correct? And that's actually quite a difficult problem to address. Okay. And finally, the model is a simplification of the system. And so you have a question of how well is, even if logically it's doing exactly what you want it to, if you've made a simplification, how well does it actually represent the system? Okay. So, next lecture we'll look a bit about input validation and this question of if we have, again, observed samples, how confident are they that those observations adhere to a specific probability distribution? And I won't say anything more about it here because, again, we're going to go on and talk about it next time we meet. So that's all I have to say for today. The next few lectures will be taken by Connor McArdle. And I hope to have the assignment posted next week, which will again be a simulation exercise. So requiring you to write a simulation model, program a simulation model, and then do some of this analysis like confidence intervals on that model. So I hope you all enjoy the bank holiday weekend. I hope the weather actually holds for once. And I'll see you all in a few weeks.